I'm Jess Harold, EG's Deputy Legal Editor, and I'm speaking today with Nicholas Dowding QC, one of the leading barristers specialising in commercial property. Nick has been described as a star of the property bar by Who's Who Legal, and the 2017 Chambers UK Guide said that he remains the top-ranked silk in the real estate litigation bar. In a league of his own, with an outstanding brain. Last year, after a long and distinguished career at Falcon Chambers, Nick took that outstanding brain to Malcolm Hollis, becoming the firm's in-house legal counsel in a pioneering move. Now that he is thoroughly settled in, we have asked Nick along to EG to discuss how he is bringing the worlds of the law and surveying together. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Jess.
Now, we're fast approaching 1 year since the announcement was made that you were moving from Falcon Chambers to Malcolm Hollis. That took effect from the 1st of July, I believe?
Yes, it was early July, yeah. Around the 1st, certainly.
And how have you enjoyed life there so far?
Well, do you know, I'm enjoying life hugely. I really am having a lot of fun. I'm not going to pretend that it hasn't been without its challenges. There were things about life in a corporate firm that I hadn't really seen coming. Indeed, when my departure from Falcon Chambers was announced, several of my solicitor friends thought it a great joke to ring me up and ask if I'd ever heard about a timesheet. When I said no, I was afraid I hadn't, and what was it? That always met with great gales of laughter. There have been a few challenges. Malcolm Hollis is a large corporate firm, as you know. It has offices up and down the country and also in Europe. It's very different in some ways from Falcon Chambers, which was a much smaller working environment. But it's a very similar working culture, actually. And I think the thing that I have been most... well, not so much surprised, but pleased by, is that it's a really nice place to work for much the same reasons that Falcon Chambers was a nice place to work. There's a real sense of people working together, of a professional family, of a team support, that kind of thing. And I think I'm very lucky to find that again. And, you know, frankly, to put it shortly, I've acquired a new lease of life.
Oh, well, we're very glad to hear it. Now, the move gained quite a lot of attention at the time. It was quite a novel one, and I know people are interested to hear more about the decision-making process and what went into that. So what were you looking to achieve by joining Malcolm Hollis, and have you found what you were looking for?
I think there were probably two factors, one probably more important than the other. I think, starting to need a new challenge. I joined Falcon Chambers in 1980, which is a very, very long time ago now. And I practiced there for well over 35 years. Many of the people who I practiced with, I grew up with. It's not, I think, that life at the self-employed bar had become less challenging, because, if anything, the opposite was the case. But I'd been in more or less every possible court. I'd appeared for almost every possible kind of client, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think I wanted to see what else I could do. I think I wanted to see where else I could take my skills, what other professional sphere I might be able to practice in. I think the second, perhaps less, but nonetheless important, was getting the... work-life balance, right? I was really working all hours for many, many years. And although I very much enjoyed being in court, I don't think many people appreciate quite how much time and energy and weekends and small hours of the morning go into preparing a big witness action or a big appeal. I mean, you have an enormous number of... trial bundles to cope with, where you have to know really pretty much what's going on every page. And you can spend an hour or more with your team debating the pros and cons of a single question in cross-examination. And I think I was looking for a little bit more balance between work and play, as it were. I think I found both of those things at... Malcolm Hollis. It is challenging, but I'm enjoying the challenge. and the work-life balance is better. Whether it will go on being better, I don't know, because professional life has a distressing habit of sucking you in. So whether or not I will be sucked into my new life the way I was sucked into my old life, I don't know. Yeah. But the answer is, well, that's what I was hoping to achieve. And yes, so far, I think I found it.
Well, we won't ask you to name and shame the bad and ugly clients, and you talk about work-life balance, but we'll concentrate on the work first. It sounds that you have a number of different roles at Malcolm Hollis. I think that's what
yes,
we said
that is
when
right.
we spoke
yes,
about
do.
It. So yes. Can you talk us through your sort of typical kind of working week and the types of work that you do take on?
Well, one of the good things is that my working week is never really the same from one week to the next. I suppose, like professional life in chambers, it's always varied. My roles, I think, are broadly these. I have what I have learnt to call an external facing role, in which I give advice to the firm's corporate clients on property law matters. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty similar to what I did at Fulcan Chambers. It's not limited to dilapidations work. Nor is it limited to cases in which Malcolm Hollis are already involved in another capacity. So, for example, I still advise on rent reviews and other property law matters in the same way I always have. That is probably the principal role, I think. I also have an internal facing role where I advise the firm surveyors on matters that they're working with internally or advising on. I have an internal training role where I give guidance to the firm surveyors and other personnel on recent legal developments, legal issues and aspects that come up time and time again in practice, where I work very closely with Vivian King, who I think you know is the other in-house lawyer at Malcolm Hollis. So that's three, but there are more. I continue to act as an arbitrator or independent expert in resolving legal disputes. That's always been an important part of my work, and I'm very glad to be able to go on doing that. I give external lectures and talks under the Malcolm Hollis umbrella. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you were involved, for example, last week with the Index conference in Warwick,
but sadly, not.
Well, I'm sorry, we missed you in that case. I did look out for you, but I gave a paper to the RICS there on the giving of reasons in expert determinations. And although it's not part of my Hollis functions, I keep up my book writing and book editing. As you know, we've just published the sixth edition of the Dilapidations book.
Yes,
and
yes.
I remain a joint editor of Woodfall and Landlord and Tenant, and so on.
With all that, it does sound as if it's every bit as difficult to maintain work-life balance as it was at Fulcan Chambers.
Well, I live in hope, is all I can say.
So, now that you've spent some time at Malcolm Hollis and you've spent time working closely with surveyors, what have you found? What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that surveyors have about lawyers?
I think that all professions have misconceptions about other professions. Quite often I think it's just good-humoured banter, really. I don't think surveyors are any exception to that. I have to say no surveyor at Malcolm Hollis has expressed any conception or misconception to me yet about lawyers, but that is probably not entirely surprising because I'm an in-house lawyer and they probably don't want to offend me. I mean, the ones I've encountered more generally, I think, are the usual stereotypes. Lawyers are stuffy, we're unapproachable, we're not always rooted in the commercial realities of matters, we're inclined to treat, questions as questions of broad legal principle instead of appreciating that they're really fact-sensitive, and we're unwilling to commit ourselves. I think perhaps if there is a conception or misconception, that's perhaps the biggest, that the old joke that if you put two lawyers in a room, you're going to get at least three answers, if not more. But I think it's all, in the end, it's all good-natured banter. I mean, like all stereotypes, no doubt there's a grain of truth. But I think both professions are highly skilled, and I think we all recognise that we all contribute equally to the cases in which we're jointly involved.
And need to work together. But turning that banter around, how about lawyers and surveyors? What do you think the biggest misconceptions are there?
I feel even less comfortable answering that because I've always had a huge amount of time for surveyors, mm-hmm. and I've gone to a surveying firm, and I've spent a lot of my time in surveyors' company. I think lawyers perhaps sometimes assume that surveyors are overly practical people. You know, they spend all their time up a ladder or in a boiler room or you know, at an estate agent's office looking at comparables. And I think perhaps sometimes lawyers, but because we tend to be people of paper in many ways, I don't think sometimes lawyers appreciate the considerable amount of thinking and reading and research that goes into finalising a surveyor's report or a surveyor's opinion. I think perhaps one of the privileges I've had to see all that behind the scenes is that actually one does appreciate what an enormous amount of work that doesn't actually involve going up a ladder that goes into it. But again, it's good human stuff. Yeah. I think one of the great pleasures, I think, of property law is that it's one of those cases, it may be tax laws, another with accountants, where at least two professions work together in, you know, mainly in harmony.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything that the legal profession could learn from the surveying profession?
Well, I'm tempted to answer that literally, I think. I mean, we could probably learn how to repair a roof or fix a boiler or something like that.
Climb a ladder.
We can probably just about manage that. No doubt are things each profession could learn from the other. Nothing really springs to mind, I think, about that, except perhaps possibly I think surveyors' practice is rooted in the particular facts of the particular matter they're dealing with. And if there is a boring old stereotype about lawyers, it can be a little bit that we treat things as sort of broad questions of terribly important general principle. And perhaps, you know, sometimes getting immersed more in the facts is rather more important.
Now, you mentioned dilapidations, and you're of course renowned as an expert in that field. As you say, you have written the book on the topic, quite literally, or at least co-authored it. It tends to be an area where people always seem to have a lot of questions, or new issues keep on cropping up. What do you think makes it that kind of topic?
I think one reason is the enormous number of dilapidations claims there are. Unlike claims for other breaches of covenant, unlawful subletting or whatever it is, dilapidations claims are more or less universal. They've come to be seen as a part of the ritual of lease expiry. I mean, there are no doubt some landlords who regard them as a sort of additional last instalment of rent. I think there are a lot of claims. All leases, or virtually all commercial leases, have got some form of repairing covenant. All buildings deteriorate over time, and therefore they're likely to be in a worse condition at the end of the lease. And so I think for those reasons there are a lot of claims, and so when you get a lot of claims, you're bound to get more issues than when you only get one or two. As to why new questions and new issues arise, I think one recent development, well, it's not recent really, is that building technology, particularly mechanical and electrical technology, continues to develop at speed. So the sort of kit that's going to be in a building, this is particularly true of offices, I think, at the beginning of a lease, is probably going to be outdated or at least not state-of-the-art at the end. So that inevitably encourages claims and counterclaims about what the tenant has to do in terms of repairing or replacing it at the end. And I think the other thing is, you know, there are now more regulations than there were. I mean, examples that I think spring to mind are the regulations banning or prohibiting the use of HFCs and HCFCs in refrigerant gas. The minimum energy efficiency standards, all these things create new problems as they work their way through and bring up new issues. But I think mainly it's because we don't yet have a standard form of commercial lease and we don't yet have a standard form of building. So every case is different. Every case provokes some kind of dilapidations claim. So I think issues will go on tumbling out.
And what are you seeing as the major dilapidations battlegrounds at the moment? And looking ahead over the next few years, what do you think will be some of the major grounds of dispute?
I think the ones at the moment, the current ones at the moment, I think are the old favourites, really. The boundary line between repair and improvement Has been with us since the beginning of time, and I think will go on being with us till the crack of doom. Particularly, I think, in the context of mechanical and electrical plant, where landlords inevitably argue something needs to be replaced and replaced with its modern equivalent, and tenants inevitably argue it can be patched up and go on for a few more years. I think the other thing is equally ancient, and that is loss of rent claims. Most people include loss of rent claims in their claims. They're not discouraged by the fact that the courts have very rarely allowed loss of rent claims to succeed. They form a more or less ubiquitous part of dilapidations claims. As to the future, well, the minimum energy efficiency standards, I think, are going to impact on claims, probably to a considerable extent in, obviously, in less energy efficient buildings. I think also what I have begun to see much more of is the inclusion in leases of provisions designed to try and make life easier for landlords on terminal claims. And I have in mind particular liquidated damages clauses. Mm-hmm. Leases provide, for example, that at the end of the term the tenant's got to pay the cost of carrying out the schedule or whatever it is. Those give rise to all sorts of issues in terms of do they work under Section 18, are they a penalty clause and stuff like that. But it is a definite trend, I think. Whether it will continue, I don't know. Certainly it's quite common in Scotland, where, as you know, they don't have Section 18, and I think that will bring up new problems of interpretation and operation.
Now, here comes the science bit, as they say in the shampoo ads. We had a speak with a number of legal contacts who who offered a few specific dilapidations queries
Do I need a job number or not?
Yeah, to tax that outstanding brain of yours. So we were interested to hear your thoughts on these. First up, when a full repairing lease terminates and there is a sublease in place, what is the effect on the dilapidations claim under the expired lease?
Well, it's quite common that a sublease continues after the end of the expired lease under the provisions of the Landlord and Tenant Act. And when that happens, the head landlord will come into a direct contractual relationship with the subtenant. So he will have a direct claim against the subtenant for continuing disrepair on and after the term date. Even when a sublease isn't full repairing, there may be service charge provision. So a landlord who carries out work after the end of the expired lease may have a claim against the subtenant under the service charge provisions. And both of those matters will potentially impact on claims for damages against the head tenant, because they may affect the valuation of the reversion, and they may affect the valuation of the reversion because a notional purchaser will say to himself, the reversion I'm buying has got this sublease in place, the subtenant's liable to repair, it may have service charge provision. So I may be persuaded to take a less poor view of the disrepair than I might otherwise do if I'm getting a building with vacant possession. I mean, that said, it's not a decisive factor because the subtenant may be a poor covenant. He may decide not to renew, but it is undoubtedly a potential factor. And its impact, I think, has been discussed in a fair number of cases now.
Secondly, you mentioned the minimum energy efficient standard, MEES. This probably won't fundamentally change standard dilapidations procedures, but energy enhancement works, both at mid-term and at term end, will likely increase because of the requirements.
Yes.
Do you think tenants will be encouraged to use the fact that landlords have these obligations to carry out improvements to comply with MEES to argue that any repairs they would be potentially required to make would be valueless, i.e. will we see more supersession arguments by tenants to reduce dilapidations claims?
Yes, I think we're almost bound to. I mean, it obviously applies principally to buildings with an EPC rating of an F or a G. But the problem the landlord's got when he gets possession back is not so much that he's under an obligation to do MEES work, because he's not, but he can't lawfully relet until he does it. So if the value of the building lies in some other cause, it won't be so important. But if the value of the building lies in the landlord's ability to relet, mm-hmm. then he's going to have to get the F up to at least an E before he does that. And that may, not necessarily will, but it may supersede some tenants' mm-hmm. works. I mean, I think an example that I've come across a fair bit recently is lighting. I mean, you might have an office building with old-style fluorescent or halogen lighting, which may be in very serious disrepair. But if it's an F or a G, usually the easiest way to get yourself up to an E or above will be to take all that out and put LED panels in.
Yeah.
And that, I think, will be a very good example of something where the claim will be superseded, perhaps in its entirety.
Mm. And that's potentially quite a widespread application.
It is. I mean, that said, it's one thing to produce the argument. It's another thing to bring the argument home. So the answer to your question is, I think one is expecting plenty of arguments.
Yeah.
How many of them will be well-founded, who knows?
And the last technical query we have here is there a better way to reduce a tenant's repairing obligation than using a schedule of condition which seems to cause more issues than it solves?
I certainly agree with the premise behind the question about schedules of condition. There is a very simple way, actually, although whether the market will wear it, I think, is another matter. And that is simply to exclude a tenant's repairing obligation completely from a lease, replace it with a landlord's repairing obligation, with a service charge, and a cap on the service charge. And that would have advantages in many ways from everyone's point of view, because the claim for the service charge would not be a claim for damages, the landlord wouldn't need to worry about Section 18. On the other hand, if a cap could be negotiated, that would fulfil the same, or arguably the same, financial function as a schedule of condition. And a tenant who knows at the beginning that he's never going to have to pay more than whatever it is a year is likely to find his financial planning, business planning, much improved by that. Whether or not the market will wear that, as I say, I don't know. But that's always struck me as being a with one bound you're free type solution.
And that's probably all the practical advice we can ask without incurring fees. So let's move on to something else. One other thing I wanted to talk to you about is Lord Newburger, who retired last year, and I know he's someone that you count on. Count as a massive influence on your career and indeed as a friend. You both go back a long way, isn't that right?
We do indeed go back a very long way. I think I mentioned earlier I started in 1980, and when I got there, Lord Newburger was a very, very young man, having started a few years ahead of me, but not many. We shared a room together in Fulcan Chambers for some years, and I remember that really as some of my happiest times at the bar, actually. We shared a joint lug of Sherlock Holmes, vying with each other to quote the longest passages from the stories we could think of. Rumpole of the Bailey. We had a joint love of practical jokes on, as they then seemed, very elderly silks. Of course, now they all seem very young men. We were eventually, I think, for reasons of behaviour or otherwise, banished to a chamber's annex, which was promptly christened the Gulag, where we remained for a few more years until I think we'd probably done our time and we were recalled for good behaviour. as I say, they were very happy times, actually. We spent a large part of our early years doing rent-act possession work, and, you know, it was much more hit and miss in those days than it was now. There weren't skeleton arguments. Pleadings were very sparse. There were no witness statements. The judges, I think, were of varying ability and not always terribly nice. Lord Newburger and I were against each other a fair bit. And when he took silk, I had the privilege to be led by him by a number of times. So we've stayed in touch ever since, and the answer to your question is yes.
And unfortunately, Lord Newburger reached retirement age. How much of a loss to property law do you think his retirement will be, or is?
Well, it's undoubtedly a loss. I mean, he is the first modern judge that I can think of to come from a genuinely specialist property law background, and certainly the first to reach the Supreme Court. And that, I think, has inevitably fed into his judgments on property law matters, and perhaps, dare one say it, has resulted in more property law cases reaching the appellate courts. I mean, it may or may not, for example, be a coincidence that the Marks and Spencer case, which is now the leading case on implied terms, was a property law case and not a commercial law case. I think, in addition, in my lifetime, property law has acquired a much more substantial status. I mean, it's difficult, I think, to overstate that in 1980, when I started, it was very much, at least in my perception, the poor relation. We were a very small set of chambers doing it. No one else specialised in it. It wasn't really the sort of area you aspired to practice in if you wanted to be a high flyer. And I think since those early days, property law has come a very, very long way. Now, obviously, there are lots of reasons for that. But I think Lord Newburger's elevation to the judiciary, and indeed to the highest levels of the judiciary, has added to its status, the status which it now has. But I'm anxious, and I'm sure Lord Newburger, were he here, would also be anxious, not to exaggerate it. I mean, there are many judges with a property law background. I mean, Lord Justice Lewison in the Court of Appeal is a very good example, and there are others. And there are others with huge property law expertise, for example, Lord Briggs in the Supreme Court. So there won't be any effect, I don't think, on the quality of judgments in property law cases, but it is a little bit difficult not to see it as the passing of an era of some kind, I think.
Now, speaking of judges, you will have no doubt been aware of the comments from the Chancellor of the High Court, Sir Geoffrey Voss, at the Chancery Bar Association annual conference on the need to recruit more judges from the upper echelons of the bar. He said that commercial barristers of the highest quality who refuse to become judges will destroy the very infrastructure that has allowed them to prosper. I wondered what you thought about the future of the judiciary, particularly when it comes to our area of the law.
Well, the Chancellor obviously knows infinitely more than I do about who is applying and who is not applying and who ought to apply and so on. And I think if he thinks that more barristers from the upper echelons need to be recruited, then he obviously must have good reasons for saying that. I mean, from my own relatively narrow experience, a number of extremely able practitioners, both from my own chambers and other chambers, have become chancery judges in the recent past. So I don't think I've got any concerns about the future of the judiciary and property law. But obviously, that said, one must treat Sir Geoffrey's points with very great respect, because he's in the best position to know.
And as a barrister of the highest quality yourself, do you feel any tug of obligation in that direction? Is a judicial career something that interests you at all?
Well, I was privileged enough to be appointed as a deputy High Court judge, a deputy Chancery judge, although in the end I tried very few cases. In fact, I think I only tried one long contested witness action. I did enjoy it. I don't think I enjoyed it enough for it to be a full-time job. One particular terror, which never left me, oddly enough, stemmed from my school days, because I went to the sort of school where it was thought terribly amusing to pull your chair away just as you were about to sit down and then laugh uproariously when you collapsed on the floor. And what I discovered when I had to sit as a deputy High Court judge is that I was expected to come into court, face the front and bow, while the usher put my chair in behind me for me to sit down on, and I was expected to lower myself into it without looking to see whether it was there or not. And it really was a great act of faith, actually. And I couldn't free myself from the old terrors of school that I would sit down and it wouldn't be there and I would disappear from view. But I think, more seriously, I did enjoy it, but I don't have judicial aspirations. I think I would miss the interaction with clients and colleagues, which have always been a very important part of what I've done. And I think I'd miss the rough and tumble of life in the front line. I mean, I'm not going to be in the front line in quite the same way as I was, because I no longer have rights of audience in court. But the rough and tumble of professional life, the camaraderie of professional life, I wouldn't want to, I think, leave that behind. That said, I mean, I do very much enjoy my arbitration and independent expert work. But that's just a part of my professional life and not the whole of it. And I think what I would have found difficult, perhaps, is being a judge all the time rather than some of the time.
Do you think the arbitration side is something that is going to increase in importance and prominence over the years to come?
Well, I very much hope it will. I mean, I think we have before us, as I think you may have heard me say before, an almost perfect model in the rent review field, where arbitration has worked an absolute treat in removing valuation disputes from the courts and having them tried by expert valuers, and by and large creating a sort of separate parallel jurisdiction. I've never seen why arbitration shouldn't work equally well, and indeed independent expert determination as well, in other fields, particularly dilapidations, where one might easily have a building surveyor arbitrator, a valuer arbitrator, or a lawyer arbitrator with a building surveyor assessor or whatever. And I very much hope that we will see an improvement in that. Whether we will, I don't know, because the major difference, of course, is that arbitration is written into rent review clauses in leases, so the parties have no ability to weasel their way out, as it were. But the usual problem in combative disputes is that one party proposes arbitration and the other party thinks, well, I don't know, but they're up to something. I know they're up to something, and says no. And I hope very much that will decrease and we'll see more arbitrations and indeed independent expert determinations as well.
Well, to return to where we started with work-life balance, I think we've had about half an hour on work, so one question for life probably isn't too bad. I sort of saw on your Malcolm Hollis bio that you have some relatively action-packed hobbies that keep you busy away from property law. What can you tell us about Kit Kat and Orion?
One is a horse and the other is a boat. Kit Kat is a fiercely independent-minded chestnut Irish cob who comes from Tipperary.
It's a long way.
It is a long way, as you say. He's never quite, I think, reconciled himself to the poor quality of grass in England as opposed to grass in the Republic. He has short legs and a rather large bottom. Neither of us together are any good at conventional equestrian pursuits, so we spend our time hacking round the forests and fields of the Suffolk countryside. To the vast amusement of my new colleagues, I occasionally return with a minor injury of some kind, the latest of which was a black eye, which I caused by hitting myself in the eye with my own riding whip when Kit Kat unilaterally came to the conclusion he was being chased by a wolf and took off, and my hand shot up. Orion, the boat, is an elderly, very elderly actually, not quite as elderly as me, long keel yacht, which I keep on the River Orwell, and on which I occasionally venture across the North Sea to the continent and up and down the East Coast. Both of them keep me sane. I'm tempted to say both of them keep me young, but certainly both of them keep me on my toes.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Nick, and best of luck with your continuing career at Malcolm Hollis, and we hope you remain relatively injury-free on Kit Kat in the years to come.
Well, that's very kind. It's been a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jess.